true hedonist and a tzaddik. Okay. Now, I just mentioned that the fact that in our society you don't have such a phenomenon. But there were societies years ago where they recognized that man cannot be happy with just physical enjoyment. So they were thinkers. So there were people that those societies were much deeper. In today's society, it's just nonsensical people, people that are brainless, basically. Just their philosophy is whatever feels good is good, and they just follow their fantasies without any analysis whatsoever. But the question is nevertheless a good one, even though I don't think it's too practical, but the question is, from a theoretical standpoint, it's a good question. What's the difference in a person that enjoys chachma and what we call a virtuous individual or a tzaddik? Yes.
In taking this question, trying to put like a practical spin on it, people think that if they learn and don't work on the Midos element to it, you know, that just leads up after one, you're just going to lead to the other. That if I learn, eventually it's going to kick in without really working on the developmental or developing the integration of the learning.
Okay. The, yes, that's part of it. That's part of it. the answer is that in Yadus, you see, Yadus places a very strong emphasis on perfection. And as much as it respects learning, it always places perfection in a higher role than intellectual prowess. And this you see, for instance, from the Gemara, where the Gemara says that Ishbosheth would embarrass David HaMelech and would tell him to Isa, you made a mistake. So he was a bigger Lamdin, but he was not David. David was still was Mashiach Hashem, and Ishbosheth wasn't. There was Nenash because of that. So you see that in Yadus, as great as much as we recognize intellectual prowess, we still subordinate it completely to perfection. And the reason is that Yadus wants to do is create a perfected person. Intellectuality is a necessary part of that perfection. Without intellectuality, there's no perfection. But intellectuality is not perfection per se. What perfection per se is an individual, a human being, that is looking for truth and reality. That's the perfection of man in Yadus. his mental abilities, whatever they may be, have to be geared towards this quest, the quest of what is truth. Therefore, all the bad mitos that a person has really are a denial of truth. Denial of truth. If a person is a balgaiva, it means that he's a balgaiva, he's hoardy. It means that he's not living in line with truth. That's the greatest mistruth, is gaiva. That's why gaiva is the worst mito. But all the bad midos are a denial of a truth. There's no mita per se that is bad unless it distorts a truth or a reality. If a person has kinah, a person has envy, so it's a distortion of a truth. The truth is that God gave each individual his own realm of existence, and this person is comparing his realm with somebody else's, and he thinks he's entitled to the other person's. That's a distortion of truth. It's not true. Okay? Taiva is a distortion of truth, because taiva maintains that through physical pleasures, man will attain some kind of happiness through his gratification. You see, it's not true. It's not true. Man is not satisfied with that. Okay? So every bad mida is a bad mida insofar as it takes a person away from the truth. That's why certain midas at certain times are good, certain times are no good. For instance, by shonas, a person being ashamed, having the ability to be ashamed, to become red-faced, to be able to feel really bad about himself, that is considered a wonderful mida. Wonderful mida. Matter of fact, Gemara says a person that can't have such an experience can't fear God. That's what Chazal is saying. That the contrary. A person must be a Baishan. That's three mitzvahs are found in this nation. One is Baishanus. Gemara says a person that doesn't have Baishanus, a person that can't feel shame, can't be Yareas Hashem. And he's a Chote. He's going to be a Chote. Why? Because Baishanus is a Mida that's in line with reality. A person who is a Baishan, a person has to be a Baishan, because a person, when he reflects upon his inner world and his inner life, has to realize that he falls short from the from what reality is. And before God, he must feel a certain shame. If he can't experience that, he can't be a Yerei Es Hashem. Simultaneously, though, Chazal say, Lo Baishan Lamed, which means to say this wonderful Midah must be put aside when it comes to Talmud Torah. So that's why what Yadus does is Yadus at one point, at certain points, it endorses certain Midos, at other points it rejects them. Why? Because it's not the Midah per se. It's the question is, how much truth does the person partake of if he's under this Midah or that Midah? the whole of Yadus is really one thing. That a person should be involved in the quest for what is the truth. What is the truth? Now, when I say what is the truth, it means, of course, philosophically. Philosophically, the world of philosophy revolves around two questions. One question is, what is reality? That's one question. And the second question is, what is man? That's the whole world of philosophy. Two questions. What is reality and what is man? You have to answer those two questions. Of course, let's say, for instance, you know what reality is. But then you'll say, that's very nice, but man's nature is not in line with it. You can't partake of that reality, like an animal. You'll say a monkey isn't living in reality. The monkey can't live in reality because the monkey doesn't know what reality is. And if the monkey tries to live in reality, if such a thing were possible, he would be in total pain. So therefore, the life of the monkey has to be a life that's limited to his framework, which is not reality, which is gratification. Okay? So the same thing is true with man. And any arguments which are presented against Yahadus will always be presented in one of those two frameworks. Either the argument we present is not reality, or if it is reality, it's not for man. It's not for man. Okay? Different philosophies emphasize different aspects of this of these two questions. For instance, the early philosophers, Plato, Aristotle, emphasize very, very strongly what is reality. What is reality? What is man? They didn't really go into to that great, great degree. Freud, on the other hand, Freud's philosophy was completely what is man, nothing to do with what is reality. You see, Yadus approaches both of those questions equally. It approaches it in terms of what is reality, and it approaches it in terms of what is man. But the Yadus says to man, first of all, it shows him what reality is, what the world of reality is, and secondly, it says that he is capable of being involved in that world, and that and if he properly understands himself, he's capable of being involved in that world, and if he does, it is of the greatest benefit to him, and affords him the greatest happiness, the greatest type of existence. A person who's just interested in the enjoyment of intellectuality, like you mentioned before, is not a person that can enjoy reality. It means to say he's interested in engaging himself in a certain kind of intellectual pleasure, just like a person that likes to play chess. Chess is an intellectual game. It's a game of the mind. But it has nothing to do with reality. A person's going to play chess, maybe if a person plays chess once or twice or three times, he can gain some insight into some process of thinking. But the people that play chess constantly, they're beyond that. They're not getting any new insights in terms of universal truths. But they do enjoy the intellectual challenge. So that's the enjoyment of activating a certain part of their makeup, which is the mind. Just like a person who's a muscle man and enjoys working his muscles. And some people enjoy working their minds. But that's not because of a quest for truth. It's just because of the enjoyment of the function. That's not what Yadus is all about. Yadus The Yadis would say, no doubt, that this person is on a higher level than the person that enjoys physical activity, because he's engaging a higher part of his makeup. But in terms of the quest for reality, he's equal to the person that's just doing anything else. Can say anything else. The Yadis would probably admit that there is a greater pleasure in the pleasures of the mind than in the pleasures of the body. But Yadis maintains that the greatest pleasure is the pleasure of the perception of reality. That's the only pleasure that really gives man total fulfillment. If a person arrives at that level, then everything is a different. He sees everything differently, and he is different. It's an interesting thing, but we always think of mitzvos in terms of maaseh hamitzvah. Maaseh hamitzvah, right? Like a mitzvah of mitzvah nachas tefillin, even a mitzvah of Talmud Torah, or even an emotional mitzvah, like a mitzvah of v'samachta b'chagecha. Okay, I have mitzvah samachta b'chagecha, mitzvah rabbanan simchas purim. It's a mitzvah. So what is the mitzvah? The mitzvah is to make yourself happy. Okay, we have such mitzvahs like that. It means to first remove. He has to have. Yeah, this demands a person has a certain control over his emotional life, over his inner life. And he should be able to remove certain ideas from his mind at certain times, and he should be able to engage in another aspect of his personality. He should be totally under his control. He should be able to be a tremendous Baal Simcha at one moment and be an Ovel at the next moment. Be able to do both. That's what Yadis demands. Total control over the person's inner life. But there again, it's an activity it's an internal activity. But it's an activity. It's an interesting thing that the Rambam has a mitzvah, one mitzvah, that is not an activity at all. You know what that mitzvah is? There's one mitzvah in the Rambam that's not an activity. Exactly. Leida sheyesham alakam matzai. What does Rambam say? The diaz dover ze mitzvah sasai. That's what Rambam says. It's not an activity. He doesn't say the mitzvah is even... The mitzvah is even the quest or the pursuit of this knowledge. It doesn't say that. He says, Yediyas davar zeh mitzvah aseh. It's an amazing Rambam. Rambam framed a new kind of a mitzvah, the halacha. A mitzvah of the state. The mitzvah is to be in the state of that yediya. That's the mitzvah. Why? Because that yediya, that state, is the ultimate state for man. That's the ultimate state for man. To be in that state is the mitzvah. That's the only mitzvah you have like that. To be in that state is to means because that is the state that the Torah says that man finds his fulfillment as an Adam. Basically, what the Torah says is be an Adam, and being a Yediyas Dover Zeh, the knowledge of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, of the existence of God, which affects his whole life and everything that he sees and everything that he views in the world, in the universe, in his small personal world, from the small personal world to the big picture, to the scope of the universe, all contains that one yediyah. So that is the state that Yadis aims for, and that is the difference between your. That's the answer to your question. What's the difference between a tzaddik, and a person who's an intellectual hedonist? Intellectual hedonist has nothing to do with this mitzvah. It has nothing to do with this kind of a mitzvah. Yes. The most essential aspect, really, is the idea. I mean, that's the Rambam's right. I mean, the most essential aspect. There is a tremendous enjoyment when a person understands the svar. It's a tremendous enjoyment. But the greatest enjoyment is the knowledge of reality, what reality is, and the person's ability to bring his emotions in line with that reality. That is the greatest state for man. That's a state, of course, that results in an individual reaching the greatest level of anivus, because that's really what it does to a person. But the thing is that that's a state that a person, the Torah maintains, the others maintains, a person can get there, can do it. That's what I believe the Rambam means when Rambam says that every person could be like Moshe Rabbeinu. What does it mean to be like Moshe Rabbeinu? It means that he can't be like Moshe Rabbeinu. So what does it mean? It means to say that every person is capable of arriving at a true recognition, insofar as his mind is capable of what he is, what his existence is, what he understands of God, and to bring his emotions in line with the knowledge that he has in his mind. That's what Yad Vashem said. It's a completely different objective than the philosophers who were intellectual hedonists. Completely different objective. Different philosophy, different objective. The philosopher who is an intellectual hedonist really doesn't differ from the rest of the world in terms of his basic philosophy. What he's saying is pleasure is the greatest good. But he is saying that you're making a mistake insofar as what you think pleasure is. Yeah, you're the average dummy thinks pleasure is physical enjoyment. It's a mistake. Physical enjoyments are very limited. If you really want pleasure, you should look for the pleasures of the mind. Those are the greatest pleasures. Those are the pleasures that are endless, and those are the pleasures that a person can put all his energies into, and those are the things that he can truly enjoy to a far greater degree. It's correct. It's true. But that's still not the aim of Yadus. Still not the aim of Yadus. Because the Yadus isn't satisfied with a person engaging in pleasure. Yadus wants a person to have a whole different perception of reality. Whole different perception and a different objective. And of course, as I said before, intellectuality is something which is indispensable in that quest. But it's not the it can be twisted in a way that you'll obviate the entire quest. And that's in your case, where the intellectual hedonism. And the Rambam in the mitzvah of Avas Hashem, and we say in the mitzvah of Talmud Torah, that part of the mitzvah is to enjoy it. If you don't enjoy it, then there's something wrong. Something wrong. It means to say it's natural for man to enjoy it. And if he doesn't enjoy it, then there's something wrong with the way he's learning. It can't be Lishma. Lishma naturally results in pleasure. If you don't experience an enjoyment in learning, then that means there's something wrong with your learning itself. Okay? The purpose of the learning is not the enjoyment. But if the enjoyment isn't there, if you don't enjoy it, then you're not learning properly. There's something wrong.
Reality?
It's something to say you're not learning for the right reason. If you're learning for the right reason, you naturally enjoy it. It's like saying if a person's eating a good steak, and he doesn't enjoy it. So what does it mean? There's something wrong with him. There's some kind of psychological problem. There's something wrong. He's not eating it. He's not partaking of pleasure properly. There's something disturbing him. He can't enjoy himself. So the same thing with learning. Learning requires a certain state where he's engaged in an activity which naturally should give man great enjoyment if everything's fine. If there's something wrong, then there's something wrong in his motivation of learning, or his idea of learning, his approach to learning, some distortion there. Something's wrong. It's a signal, in other words, basically. If a person doesn't enjoy learning, it's a signal something wrong. And he can't learn Lishma. Okay. Actually, the Avas Hashem. Avas Hashem is impossible without the enjoyment of learning. If you don't have the enjoyment, you can't have Avas Hashem. Because the Avas Hashem stems from the fact that the person is drawn to this, and he enjoys it. If there's no enjoyment there, there's no... The whole emotional state of Avas Hashem can't come into existence. Avas Hashem is an emotional state. It's an emotional state, but it's an emotional state which is based on a certain framework of ideas, but it involves the emotions too, because if the emotions don't follow, then there's an imperfection. But it's an imperfection, something's wrong. That's really the difference between Tzadik Gomer and Tzadik Eina Gomer. Tzadik Gomer is a person whose emotions follow his mind. Tzadik She'ina Gomer means the tzadik, but there's somehow or other, he can't get his emotions to be in line with the ideas in his mind. It's an imperfection. It's an imperfection. But don't get me wrong, he's still a tzaddik. Okay. The emotions have to be there because, you see, a person is emotional. A person has emotions. You cannot close off emotions. A person's not a malach. Now, there's a certain way of life. In other words, all the energy that you use have to come from emotions. It can't come from anywhere else. Now, if the emotions don't follow, so it means that the function has to be disrupted. In order for a person to function properly, the emotions have to be in line. If the emotions are not in line, then they're drawing energy in different directions, and you can't have the proper function. It's an impossibility. I mean, it's like saying a person. Why does a person need to be healthy? Why can't a person be in total pain and also be a perfected person? The answer is impossible, because if he's in total pain, so then all the energies are being drawn towards the pain. He can't be involved in the chachma. It's impossible. It's what Rambam says. A person should take care of his health. Why? Not because of the health itself. That's not perfection. But because in that state is the best state in which you can pursue knowledge. If a person is unhealthy, if a person has physical problems, so then he can't pursue thought. He's disturbed. Energy is being drawn away into different areas. The same thing is true of the emotions. If the emotions are being pulled in different directions, you can't have the state in which the person could be involved in the activity which is natural to him. So you can't have imperfected emotions. And the natural state is when the person is really free, the person will naturally enjoy chachma. The person doesn't enjoy chachma, it means that he's not free. It means emotions are pulling in different directions. It's not the pull is there's a pull indicated here. If there's no pull, the person should naturally enjoy it. That's the way man is made. That's the way man is constructed. So man has a certain way of a certain kind of mental state in which he will experience enjoyment, and in which the energies can flow towards this activity. But if he's not enjoying himself, so then it's a sign that the energies are really being drawn, whether consciously or unconsciously, are being drawn in different directions. So he can't be free to pursue this. And because he's not free, so his mind doesn't see certain points, he can't. He's going to miss. He will miss a lot of truths. Also, it affects everything. It doesn't just affect the ability in terms of time of a person putting his energies into learning. Time is a big factor, but it's not the only factor. There are other factors. Where the mind goes, what the mind sees. And this depends on, you need a personality that's a free personality to be able to see and to investigate and to see, uncover ideas. The personality has more to do with uncovering ideas than the intellect, really. And the greatest discoveries were not made necessarily by great minds. A person can't be a fool and make a great discovery. But it wasn't. They weren't made by the greatest intellectuals. They were made by people who were drawn because of a certain search for truth in different directions. And they used their intellectual powers in certain areas. But the personality is the emotions play a very vital role. The person is drawn to a problem and he's involved in it. That's when his mind is going to work. He can have the greatest mind, but he's not drawn to it, he's not interested, he's not going to do much. I mean, maybe on the surface he'll be able to throw around a few facts or come up with one idea or something, but he can't really. The area of thinking is very deep. It takes time and effort and patience and tenacity. And those qualities stem from the personality more than the intellect. So that's why if the personality is not the person isn't happy in learning, then there's something wrong with the personality. It's going to infringe on his ability to learn in terms of quantity, and also, even more important, in terms of quality. Okay. The question is free will. So, like I said, there's enormous amount of material, philosophical material, on this question. Is there free will? Is there not free will? And there are debates, tremendous debates among the greatest thinkers on this point. Now, it's not a simple point. Not a simple point. It's not something I would tackle initially. But sometimes a solution to a problem is one which is very difficult to find, very evasive, because of the fact that the answer is very straightforward and simple, and because of that, it eludes the human mind. But I think Bechir is one of those areas. And if you look at philosophers will always say that the ones that are against free will, it is a dilemma. It's a serious dilemma. It's a dilemma in an objective way. It's a dilemma in a subjective way, because nobody really believes personally that there's no Bechir. It's simply a matter of if a person would believe the way, he simply would not be able to exist. The existence of man is contingent upon the fact that if you tell somebody, look, what are you doing with yourself? It's impossible on a human level, even though, as a matter of fact, psychoanalysts point out that people that deny free will inevitably sooner or later get caught in statements that indicate that they really do believe in free will. It's an unbelievable thing. On the one hand, man must believe in free will. Otherwise, why am I doing this? I want to make a decision. All these things, these concepts of decision-making and doing things are based on a concept of free will. If you don't have free will, your whole decision-making process is worthless, and there's nothing, you can't do anything. You can't move. I mean, your movement is based on a concept of free will. I get up in the morning, I want to, well, what should I do? What should I do? You have no free will. You can't determine what you're going to do. It's impossible on a pragmatic level. I mean, that's where the word pragmatic belongs. And people just use pragmatic indiscriminately. They use it in place of practical. Doesn't mean that. Pragmatic means where you, by definition, have got to employ a certain kind of concept. Okay, on a pragmatic level, it's impossible to avoid the concept of free will. Yet philosophically, it's one which is very difficult to comprehend, because and the question that people always raises, that everything in the universe always has a cause. There's always a causative element. There's always causation is built into the universe. And now you're telling me that there's no causality over here. Correct? All right. That's most of the questions that are raised against free will are of that type. That you're denying, there's a denial of causality. Okay? All right. When I say pragmatically, I mean, if there's no free will, man has to totally live a lie. He's living a lie constantly. And it comes out that he's destined to live a life of a lie. Otherwise, he can't function. Oh, yes, it could be. I'm not saying it can't be. I'm saying it could be. But I'm just saying that you have to include that in the dilemma. When you look at this dilemma, you have to include that as a factor. I mean, it's not something to be overlooked. Okay? But you're right. That's on a subjective level, pragmatically. But it has no bearing on the objective philosophical question as to whether we are all living a lie or not. Okay, that's correct. Yes? I mean, he mentioned the skeptics. What I want to tell you is an extremely important thing, and that is skepticism is today's upper courses. Skepticism is today's college world. When I say college world, I mean the professors and the educators and the big chachamim in today's world. Skepticism is really today's brand of upper courses. It is the most devastating philosophy that you can have, the most devastating apocalypsis. Because what it means is that man has no ability whatsoever to determine what is reality, what's not reality, certainly in the sphere in philosophy and psychology. And what it does is, it's not even consistent, because basically what happens is like this. It is the out for hedonism. It's basically the foundation of hedonism. That's what it is. The foundation of hedonism. Because what happens is like this. And what does it come from? It stems from one thing. It stems from the fact that people out there are not really great chachamim today. And therefore they see this opinion, that opinion. They have no way of coping with any of these ideas, and have no system of getting out of the endless questions and confusion of the mind. So they say there is no answer. So nobody knows anything. So that means to say that the great chacham is like the great fool. I might as well just do what I feel is right. And then they adopt, but I'll tell you one thing. The practical results of skepticism is an adoption of a definite hedonism. There they're not skeptical. And I get it to you. They lose the skepticism once they get the hedonism. That's the that's today's world of philosophy. That's where it's at.
Okay.
If you were a real skeptic and you weren't a hedonist, you'd think twice before you indulge in a taifa. You say, well, I don't know. It's not good. Wouldn't matter what you did, actually. Wouldn't make any difference. You wouldn't feel any worse if you lost the lottery and you did, if you won the lottery. For the exact same way, you're a skeptic, real skeptic. That's a skeptic. Not too many guys like that. You can't know the truth. So, next step is he indulges in all his pleasures. That he's very certain about. Yeah. There are no real skeptics. Real skeptic is almost impossible to live such a life of a real skeptic. But the skepticism itself is intrinsically self-contradictory. Because if you posit skepticism, then you're not skeptical anymore. Saying that this is true. if it's true that you don't know anything, so that's a truth. Then there's no truth. But if there's no truth, so how can this be a truth? So skepticism is internally contradictory as a philosophy. Just like the same thing with empiricism. Empiricism is self-destructive, because you cannot be a real empiricist. Because the moment you say I am an empiricist, that's not empirical anymore. Of course, being an empiricist is not an empirical phenomenon. So empiricism itself is self-destructive. But people don't seem to mind these type of contradictions. People do not seem to mind. Even great philosophers, as strange as it sounds, they build these whole systems, even though the system is standing on an internal contradiction, somehow or other they fail to recognize their contradiction. I don't know why it is, but that's the way it is. That's the way it is. Great, great minds, too. It's a strange phenomenon. It's like David Hume. He said that there's no such thing as causality. Causality is an illusion. And then he proceeded to say why we believe there is such a thing as causality. I was looking for a cause. Yeah. Okay. So at any rate, he said the cause is definitely habit. No question about that cause. Okay. So. Now the question, getting back to the question of free will, so I want to keep skepticism out, but this is something that you should take to heart. I mean, it's important. I would say that the worst, you know, people worry about upper courses, going to a university, upper courses, you're going to read about this apicurus, that apicurus. That wouldn't be that bad as the general environment, intellectual environment, which is skepticism. That's 1,000 times worse. Because at least a guy accepted, even if a person believes in a certain apicurus, at least if he holds his mind to work so you can talk to him, so you can show him that apicurus is wrong. But he can't talk to anybody anymore. You're lost. The person is lost. And the person simply follows his emotions. The most devastating kind of life is resultant from today's skepticism. That's the worst apicurus.
What?
It's a funny thing. People don't know what to be afraid of. That's a problem. They don't know what to be afraid of. Like in the frum world, they're happy that no one seems to care about any specific philosophy. That's good. You see, no. On the contrary, that is the worst fear. That's the worst fear. Okay. And it's a funny thing. I mean, society always has a guise. It's a cover. It's kol adam kozeh. The world is sheker. It's covered with a sheker. And the sheker in this society is that it's that you're living in a democratic society. It's not true. It's a very dogmatic society. Dogmatic. Because students view professors with a tremendous respect, although not overtly, but covertly. When a professor in philosophy walks into the room and tells you there's no philosophy, everybody accepts it. It's complete dogmatism. No one's going to say, well, hey, professor, he knows. And yeah, exactly. It's not truly a democratic environment. Okay. But now the question of Bechira. Now the problem, the main, see, sometimes the solution to a problem lies in understanding the problem very well. If you understand the problem very well, you see, the solution is right there. It's the understanding of the problem that evades the person often. Not the solution. The solution, the reason why I can't have the solution is I understand the problem. When you understand the problem, you see there's no problem. That's the case with free will. That free will, the answer is people are looking for an answer, and free will, that they're searching and searching. There's no need to search. The answer is, you have to understand what the definition of free will is. Okay? You see, now, you started to say something that's extremely important, and that is that there is no free will when you deal with the sphere of the emotions. In other words, what people commonly, if you take a college course on free will, they'll tell you, well, I walked by the bus stop, and then I saw a hot dog stand. I was on my way to work, and I thought, well, should I have a hot dog or should I go to work? So now I'm caught with two possibilities. I have to make a decision. So I have my free will. I decided I'm going to have a hot dog. Okay. So that is not an act of free will. Nothing to do with free will. Over there, what you said before is correct. It's an illusion. Of course, the truth of the matter is that the person made the decision based upon which emotion is more powerful. That's all. He thinks he's made a decision. He didn't make a decision. His decision was predetermined. The only thing is that since there are quantitative factors going on in his mind, so one quantity, even if he goes up and back five times, it's just because of the fact that this point hit him, and then this tiger grabbed him. But he is basically operating on one thing. He's operating on the pleasure-pain principle, and there are different thoughts that are coming into the equation. And then all of a sudden, the one that's the side that is most powerful is going to succeed. But he didn't really. His decision was made when he got up in the morning. His decision was going to follow his divers. That was the decision. All right. But now we say like this. That's why Yadda says, what it says in the Torah. The Chazal say, when it says in the Torah that Reina Sadla Fanecha Yom Esachayim V'Samovas V'Satov V'Sarov V'Charta B'Chayim, the Torah says Bechira. So the Gemara says, who believes Rabbi Yechanan says that until that day there was no Bechira. That was the first time that Bechira. Why? Because Bechira in Yadus is a very specific phenomenon. It's a phenomenon where a person is confronted with two different worlds: the world of ideas, thought, reality, that part of the mind that can tune into that world. And then there's another world, a world that's constantly operating, and that's the world of the desires. Now, what Yadda says is that a person can choose between those two worlds. Okay? Now, the kasha, the question that's stacked against Bechira Chofshis is always, but that's a denial of causality. In causality, everything in the universe works by causality. Yeah, but they don't understand something. Everything works by causality. Do we believe in God? Well, what about causality for God? So the answer is that causality means that there is a... If a person traces the causes back, he has to come to something who is not caused. Otherwise, it's ad infinitum. So therefore, we say that there is some existence, there is an existence whose essence is to exist and is not pre-caused, which means that God is unique. So in other words, when you're studying the world of causality, you're studying the world that was created by God. And in that created world, things work by causality. But God himself is outside that realm. So when you're talking about God, you can't apply the rules of causality to God. It's an internal absurdity, because the rules of causality are the rules in the created world. But now you're saying that there's something outside the created world, so how can I apply rules from the created world outside the created world? Doesn't make any sense. It logically doesn't make any sense. Okay? Now, whether scientists like that or not is a different story. A scientist doesn't like that because it means that his world is limited. He can't go outside that world. But logically, it's inappropriate. Okay? Now, what the Torah means by Bechira, it means that everything in the universe, in the caused world, in the world of existence, is programmed. Which means to say, an animal, all the events in its life, every existence is pre-programmed, okay, by causality. When we say that Adam is unique, what we mean is that that's precisely what we mean. We mean that he is not under the realm of causality. He's a unique creature. He is not So he's not a creature that is pre-programmed from the moment of birth to go through exactly the actions and the experiences that he has throughout his life. We say Bechira maintains now that he is not pre-programmed. So what you're saying is that he is out of the realm of causality. That's the very definition of Bechira. Now, if that's the definition of Bechira, now your question of how is it possible to have something outside the realm of causality is absurd, because that is the very definition of what you mean by free will. You understand what I mean? When a person says free will, what he means is precisely that in the created universe, there is one being who is not under the constraints of causation. That's exactly what it means. It means that he's a unique creature. He is something different. Now, you're going to say, but one second, but that's a denial of causality. Well, of course it is. Of course. That's precisely, definitively, what you're saying. You understand what I mean? So, all those questions and all those philosophers who keep on heaping questions on free will are really just making a mistake, because they're just, all these questions are against the very definition of what you want to say. You understand what I'm saying? So the questions are simply worthless. You understand what I'm saying? Okay? That's precisely what we're saying. You can't ask why. So why isn't God under those laws? Why? Correct. And we're saying that in the created universe there is a being that's outside the laws of causality. That's what we're saying. That they were saying that's the Tzelem Elokim. I mean, Bechira is part of Tzelem Elokim, according to Rishonim. So it means to say that's precisely what it says in Bereishis, that there is one creature who is outside the realm of the rest of the creation, which is all dictated by causation, and this being, this creature, is man. Now you can't ask questions as to one second it's a denial of causality. That's precisely what free will means. You can't ask a question on something where that's the very definition of the thing. It's absurd. Okay? In other words, is that logical? To say, well, we'll add up all the things, and whatever is true about all the things, so therefore it has to be true about everything. Is that, what kind of reasoning is that? Doesn't make any sense. No. My purpose is not to prove. Is not to prove free will. That's not the purpose of it. What I want to show you is that the idea of free will is really basically invulnerable to the attacks that are used. When you read the works of the people that attack free will, they're attacking free will with questions that deny the very concept of free will. You can't do that. That's not a legitimate argument. You can't ask a question on, if I maintain that A exists. So you can't ask a question on A based on a denial of A's existence. That's simply a denial. It's not a question, it's a denial. Okay? The confusion in free will is that people do not understand what it means, first of all, what it means, and what the realm is, because there I would say you could have questions. In other words, if a person thinks that free will is decision-making, like we mentioned before, should I go to the movies or should I go to work, that area is open to true questions. There you have legitimate questions. Why? Because when you take the person, you trace back his thoughts, you'll see that really they were determined by certain forces in his psyche. Right. That's a good question. Okay. But that area, what I said before, that is not free will. Free will is a unique phenomenon. Unique phenomenon. Free will is this situation where a human being, it can only happen to a human being, because only a human being is capable of tuning in to this other world. There is no creature that can tune into reality in the sense that a human being can. This is nothing like it. That's his uniqueness. In other words, I'm just explaining it further. The question is, why do we say that? I just answered it logically. I want to show you that there's more meaning here to this. Why do we say a person has free will? What does it mean? It means that man is... What is free will based on? Once you understand what the definition is, it's based on a certain unique faculty that man has, which is to tune into reality beyond the senses. A different world. Man is capable of seeing a whole different world. No animal can see this world. It's a world of reality that's invisible and that's real to a certain part of his makeup. He can tune into that world.
Now we say that since man is unique, he could tune into that world, but simultaneously he has the other world, so he's confronted with two worlds. So we say this unique creature can make the choice between the two worlds. Now you can't ask me the question, what about the rest of the creation? The rest of creation doesn't have that kind of a phenomena. Of course it can't, because by definition it doesn't partake of this. You understand what I mean? So all the phenomena that free will rests on are by definition non-existent in the rest of the creation. In the inanimate world, certainly not. The inanimate world certainly can't perceive anything. And in the animate world, there's no animal in the world that can perceive knowledge or can understand what the word means or have any concept of reality. Okay? So the very phenomena upon which free will is based is because of the uniqueness of man. Now, how could you ask me questions from the rest of the creation? It has causality. That's denying the whole very essence of what free will is based upon. You understand what I mean? It would be like saying, since the rest of... I'll tell you what, the question against free will amounts to the following. If I have to rephrase it, I want to rephrase it, what you say. Since the rest of the creative world has no intelligence, so man has no intelligence. That's exactly what the rationale of the question against free will amounts to. If you can accept such an argument, you say, well, since the rest of the world doesn't have any knowledge, nothing else can think. A rock can't think, a tree can't think, an animal doesn't know what reality is, okay, has no concept of reality. Since that's the case, so man also has no concept of reality. That's basically what the argument is. But once you posit that man has a concept of reality, now you're saying he's a unique creature. He can tune into something in the universe that no one else can see, no one else can partake of. And I say, because he can, he's confronted with two worlds and has the ability to choose between these two. Now, how could you ask from a question from the rest of the world on this creature who's unique and that's precisely what differentiates him from the rest of the world? The question against free will is a total absurdity. It's an intrinsic absurdity. You understand it? That is 100% true. Now, once the person accepts, for instance, if a person accepts the hedonistic world, his chances of getting out are very slim, because that means that he made one decision and his life is gone. That's it. Now, it could be that something strange can occur to him. Always have to be an external event, because Yadus maintains that the wheel of reason, even though it's suppressed somehow or other, can always be agitated. So it's always moving, and what agitates it, we don't know exactly. It's difficult, complex to know what. But the person can get up in the middle of the night one evening, and the leg can get up, and he could suddenly something start, the wheel of reason is becomes agitated and starts working, and he can get himself back into free will. Chances are very slim. I mean, that's what Chazal say. What does Chazal say? That a person goes on the Derech Ra, he's gone, basically. I mean, basically, he's gone for the rest of his life. Can't say that it's impossible that he should do tshuva. No. What does Ram say? Dvarim hamonim mesachuva, dvarim hamakvim mesachuva. Ram talks about it. Those are main as his essential things. That means a person really chooses a derech ra, his chances of return are very, very slim. As a matter of fact, there's a certain point where the pasuk says he can't come back anymore. Kol bo'ehalo yeshuvan. That certain ideology, a certain way of thinking, he can't come back. Yeah. That's correct. Yeah, that's an important. That's smart. Yeah. You see, let me. I mentioned this a number of times. I think it's a very important issue. See, in today's world, you have to understand that when you look at the world out there today, I mean the so-called intellectual world, everybody tries to make himself sound like they're very objective and scientific. I mean, that's the kolo odom kosev. It's a lie. It's a basic lie. Because the intellectuals, the scientists, are all human beings who happen to have very little knowledge of themselves. And if a person has little knowledge of themselves, they are prone to all kinds of prejudices and drives which are hidden from their eyes. I don't care what kind of Nobel Prizes they've received. It doesn't mean a thing. Okay, it doesn't mean a thing. Nothing. Zero. Now, in today's world, in today's intellectual world, you have people that, in the guise of intellectuality, try to present a certain kind of a framework which they maintain as scientific. This scientific framework can be identified. We know what it is, but it creeps up in different forms. Yadis recognized it, and Yadis rejected it outright as a falsehood that deceives man. And that way of thinking is a type of quantitative thinking, if I use a description. Quantitative thinking, not qualitative thinking, but quantitative thinking. I mean the people that are so intent on proving that man's intelligence is nothing more than a very complicated form of beast, of animal. You see, you have to understand what drives these people. What drives these people is a very dangerous emotion. Yadus maintains that people that deny Torah are not free thinkers, but they're constantly struggling with an underlying fear that maybe it's true. And that's really a Moloch. That's really a Moloch. Moloch was a Moloch. A Moloch is an attempt to prove to oneself, to the Amaleki, to prove to himself that Yadus is not true. That's the same thing, that's the whole thing with Achashverosh and the Klei HaMikdash. What is all that stuff? To prove that it's not true. If one finally proved there's nothing here. Yes, sir. Now, the Darwinians, the so-called evolutionists and Darwinians, are not, at least what I've read of them, are not objective thinkers, but there is a great fear that they're always fighting against, that maybe there is something here beyond what we see, what's beyond the visible, physical kind of science. You see, it's an interesting thing. But I want you to have this approach of the visible, physical, the science of the practical laboratory science, the Skinner type of approach. This is the old German scientific way of thinking. It expressed itself in biology, and it in psychology as well, and even in physics. That's why the two greatest Nobel Prize winners of the German scientists of the 20th century were extremely against the whole Einsteinian revolution, the worst anti-Semites. Why? Because they couldn't follow. They saw, basically, the way one writer describes it, these people who won the Nobel Prize, originally won the Nobel Prize for work in a laboratory it was work that involved experimentation and being very good at mechanics, they could not conceive. Suddenly, there's a new kind of physics where Jews mainly, essentially Jews came along who couldn't even screw in a wall. I mean, couldn't do anything. And in their minds, they're working out a whole new world. This is something which enraged them, basically, and caused tremendous anti-Semitism in the world of physics and science. They couldn't tolerate such an idea. But Yadus maintains just the opposite. That is where the Chochmah is. That is reality. That abstraction is reality. That's the real world. And the other world of mechanics is not the real world. It's only an illusory world. It seems to be that way, but when you look into it, that's not what it is. This is a big battle. The evolutionists belong to that same mode of scientific thinking, where qualitative differentiations don't exist, and we're only the quantitative. We're just more complex. Man is more complex. Basically, man is a Skinner-studied rat, and man is basically a complicated rat. There's no qualitative differentiation. And that's basically the approach, that there's no qualitative difference. Of course, there's a serious problem. What's the problem? The problem is, why is there such a gap between human intelligence, which can place a person on the moon if you want to talk practical feats, or could understand, comprehend worlds of physics and dimensions and time and space, which are completely removed from any kind of physical concept. I mean, a universe that's finite and boundless. I mean, you can't, these kind of concepts, I mean, are not to be found in reality. In the reality, at least, that the people are looking for. So, how could you possibly have such a discrepancy? Where is the evolution? How do you fill in the gap? So there is a tremendous amount of energy, drive, being placed into trying to bridge that gap and to show that man really is much different actually the gorilla or the monkey is the chimpanzee is really just he's almost a man. You see, and all kinds of experiments show that they could use language and different things, all to show, to demonstrate that there is no gap, because the gap is glaring. But the truth of the matter is that they're looking at quantitative phenomena. They're not looking at qualitative phenomena. It's not the ability to communicate. Not simply the ability to communicate. And it's not even the ability to think in terms of logical steps that differentiates man from the animal world. There certainly is, quantitatively, to my mind, there's a qualitative differentiation. But anyways, I'm not going to even argue that point. But the point, the essential thing in man is that man has the ability to recognize that the world of ideas, the abstract world, is the real world. And what I see with my eyes and what I sense with my senses is only an illusion. That's not the real world. So the animal world does not partake in any way of that quality. No chimpanzee could ever sit down and think to himself, one second, it's not the chair, and it's not the banana. It's because of the abstract lines of force, and because of the position, the relative position, and because of a concept of causality that made me capable of removing the banana from the tree. No animal can think that way. No animal can perceive, can recognize a reality beyond the physical. It's a qualitative difference in man. And the funny thing is, when you read some of these evolutionists, and they start talking about these things, you're suddenly struck with an unbelievable dilemma. That this person himself, what he's talking about, to him, the animal world is not real. It's simply a result of certain ideas and certain concepts, according to his very theory, which qualitatively differentiates him from those animals that he's talking about. But somehow or other the contradiction goes unnoticed. Goes unnoticed, you see. When an evolutionist, Wichitasso, when he sees a species, what does he see? He doesn't see the physical species. He sees certain forces that have an interplay of forces which have resulted in a certain thing. So the reality is not the particular animal anymore. The reality is those forces which can only be seen by the mind. So he himself has to admit that his world is determined by ideas which only the mind can accept as real. And the animals that he's discussing are obviously can't partake of such kind of concept. So there's an internal contradiction within the framework of that system itself. Do you understand what I mean? Okay. Actually, in terms of the evolutionists, but my point is that whole approach of science is false. And physics has shown, in this century, has shown that whole approach is false. That's against the other. I mentioned yesterday in Shia, we had an interesting Gemara. Well, the Gemara proves that a Talmud Chacham doesn't need any Shmira. Shouldn't have to pay any money to contribute. And when they build a wall around the city for protection, you have a wall, you have sentinels, you have a tower, so the Talmud Chacham doesn't have to contribute. And the Gemara says, why doesn't he have to contribute? The Gemara says, because the Torah is megging on him. How does the Gemara learn that? The Gemara learns that from a pasuk. So I said, this is completely contrary to the way the world would approach it today. In today's world, they say, well, let's see, how many Talmud Chacham were robbed? That's it. Physical phenomena. If the Talmid Chacham are robbed, so they have to contribute to the wall. Yadis doesn't see it that way. Why? Because in Yadis, it's the ideas that are the reality. If once there's a concept of Shmira, so it means that we know conceptually that this is true. Our idea of Schar V'Onesh, that's why all the world's kashas on Schar V'Onesh are nonsensical. Because Schar V'Onesh is a reality to us, not an experimental reality. Schar V'Onesh is based upon a concept, an idea, that if a person understands anything about the human soul, he knows that there must be Schar. That this, if this thing exists, that the attendant, that which is appropriate for this thing, must be infinitely greater than the enjoyment that the physical part of man can experience. It's a conceptual reality. The questions that are raised about how come this particular tzaddik encountered this particular danger are nothing compared to the theory. It's a question. Like I mentioned yesterday, in science, one scientist said it very well. He says people think all science is experimentation. Oh, really? There isn't a single theory in the world that does not have experiments that are contrary to it. Oh, so we don't have any theories. No, that's not true either. Why? Because a scientist says this experiment doesn't fit, and it must be some particular thing that's with the experiment. It's not the theory. Theory's correct. Another kind of experiment is a, that disproves the theory. So you have to have a mind to differentiate between which experiment is valid in disproving a theory and which experiment is a problem. But we don't throw the theory out. It's probably something with the experiment itself that we have to analyze. Something went wrong with it. Something, we don't understand it. It's a detail. We're missing a detail, whatever it is. But we don't throw the experiment out. So the bottom line is the human mind is the judge. Experimentation is not really, is not objective. It's not objective. It's all based upon the human mind. So the bottom line always has to be the human mind. You see, there's no such thing as experimental physics. No such thing. There is only intellectual physics. That's the only thing. And that's why you see that the one that, who made the biggest breakthrough in physics was made by Einstein. What kind of experiments? His mental, what he called the mental experiments. We have a Chazal, we have this for millennia. Mental experiments. Chakiras. Anyone knows Gemara knows what a mental experiment is. The world was a big Kiddush. Big Kiddush, mental experiment. Nev went out of his room, and he thought about a person in an elevator up in space, and then they pull the elevator up, it's just like he's on the ground. That was his big experiment. That's as far as he went. Yeah. I mean, the dilemma of man, that man is really, on the one hand, one component of him is very material and physical, and the other part of him is unbelievable. He has the ability to tune into a reality that the senses have no part in. It's Tilim Ches Pasuk Hei. He says like this, Pasuk Dalek. Kiera Shemecha Maises Bosecho Yoreh Fekochov Mashiach Kanonto Mo Enesh Kisis Kerenu Uven Odom Kisif Kedeno. I mean, his man is basically nothing. In terms of him, it was a man, a short lifespan. I mean, he lives till he grows up and reaches maturity. It's a long time. He's mature and he's in the prime of his life for a very short time, and then he starts deteriorating and deteriorates progressively until he dies and he's gone, vanished. No one even knows he existed. That's it. No one. I don't think anybody here knows who their great great grandfather was. That's it. Gone. So like they can never. There's nothing. It's like a fly on a wall. I mean, just like a fly is swatted. Just a goodbye. The only thing is that during the time, it seems like everything's so permanent. I mean, but the fact is that 100 years from now, that's it. The person is like he never existed. It's just kolohaya. Just like the tefillas in Rosh Hashanah and Kippur express it very clearly. That's it. More enosh kisis karena venonim kisif kizana. Man is basically nothing. But then, in the very next pasuk, v'atchasreyu ma'at me'elohim, v'chovod v'hodo tatreyu. So what does it mean? It means to say that man, if a person thinks of himself, what am I? If he thinks of his greatness, his grandeur, any kind of thing like that, there's one, death is an answer that it just swallows everything up. It could swallow up the greatest ego, is swallowed up by death, and it's gone. Nothing. It's the reality just swallows it up. It's just nonsensical. And all the excitement that a person has about his momentary existence is all going to be swallowed up and gone. Like it never existed. Kalahaya. But nevertheless, there's a part of man that's unbelievable. V'atchasreyu ma'at me'elohim. V'chovod v'hodo tatreyu. There's something that man has which is unbelievable, that he could tune into reality, an invisible reality. That which is responsible for everything that exists. That's an amazing thing. That's an amazing thing. So man, the answer, you see, the strange thing about man is that insofar as he thinks about himself, he's nothing. In other words, why does a person think about what he is? Because he's interested, that's an instinctual component, that stems from the instincts. Insofar as he thinks about himself, he's worthless. Insofar as he's looking for some kind of satisfaction in what he is, that component, that very component that's looking for that, is nothing. Because that component is just a part of his physical makeup, which is swallowed up and demolished and as if it never existed. But when he looks outside of himself, there is greatness. When the ability to look outside of the self, to understand the world of the infinite, to partake of the infinite, only man can do that. That's the greatness of man. So man is really, that's what a human being is. Two complete opposites. Amazing, astounding. On one hand, is zero, nothing. He dies in a second. The person doesn't even know he's going to exist tomorrow. And it could be over so quick. I mean, that's it. He's gone, like he never existed. 1 minute. make the Leviathan, take them away, goodbye, that's it, go. And next week, next month, a year later, the world goes on, he's nothing. And he doesn't even know. Chazal, I mean, people don't like to think anyway, but Chazal say that a person must know every day it could be his last day. So Chazal say a person will learn Yashlo Shalom Shosov, means every day learn the Mikra, Mishnah, and Gemara. Why? Because Miyadeh Kamachai. That's it. A person, I mean, it's true, some people die and it takes a long time, but other people just, that's it. It could be a momentary second. You see it happen all the time. No warning, nothing. That's it. And so on that score, man is nothing, zero, nothing. But on the other hand, that ability, the unique ability to be able to perceive, penetrate reality, and be in line with something that is responsible for all of reality, how could a person say there's nothing? You can't say there's nothing. It's an unbelievable thing. It's amazing. That's what Chasrei Mat Melehim. That's what a human being is. Very few people experience Bechira. The large part of the problem with Bechira is that people think that they've experienced Bechira, but it's not often in a person's life, not very often in a person's life. I'm talking about the average life. And it's not very often that there is a... And the person that experiences it is very rare. Very rare. Most people don't experience Bechira. That's it. They go through all life without Bechira. They're programmed. That's it. Raised, programmed. That's it. Today's world, and they never even know what it means. To know what Bechira is, there is, since there's a phenomenon of Bechira, there has to be an experience, a human experience of Bechira. I can't, it's something you can't describe to somebody. I mean, they have to have really been in the clutches of such a situation, where on the one hand they could see reality, they could see the truth, on the other hand they feel the overpowering force of the emotions. That is a state of Bechira, where the person is, it's a rare thing. Not everybody has even had such an experience. But that's the experience. It's a unique experience. But then the person has to decide. He feels both. He has to decide which way he's going to go. That's a Bechira. Really. It's a human phenomenon. What?
You can't really call it a choice, though.
He's the determinant of which way he's going to go. He's the determinant. That's correct. I don't believe Moshe Rabbeinu was constantly in a state of Bechira. He wasn't. He made his Bechira, and he was in the world of Chachma, and that was it. Once in that world, he's in the world. Yeah, when he had the incident with the Mei Meriva, that was Bechira. That was Bechira. But he wasn't in the state of Bechira all the time. Bechira is, once the person has made the choice and he accepts the reality of that world, there's no more Bechira, that's it. He's in it. He's in that world. The question that he asked is an excellent question. I understand that tzaddik, that is not a kovish yisro. Tzaddik, he's in the world of Chachma. That's it. He's constantly in the world of ideas. So he doesn't experience any Bechira anymore. But what about the kovish yisro? Is the kovish yisro constantly engaged in Bechira? Or is the kovish yisro, it's a one-time decision, assuming that he doesn't have any interruptions? I mean, is he also, he made one-time decision and that's it? Or is it a constant Bechira? I don't believe it's a constant Bechira. I believe that way. I believe he's also. It's not a constant Bechira. The Kovash Yisro, that decision is made already. That decision is made that when these emotions come knocking at the door, he doesn't answer. That decision was made before. Unless he encounters a new kind of situation, overpowering situation, then he can be thrown again into the realm of Bechira. You see? The distinction is in terms of the breakdown. The distinction between the Kovash Yisro and the Tzadik Gomor is not in terms of Bechira, it's in terms of the breakdown of the energies. Okay. But don't make a mistake over here. Kovash Yisro is a big Tzadik. It's a big level. Everybody always opts for the... Yeah, right. The question of elaboration on the decision-making process. The reason why you're asking that is because you're looking for causality. You can't elaborate more because you can only elaborate when you have phenomena that you can compare. Now, this is a unique phenomenon. There's nothing that you can't elaborate. There's no way to elaborate. By definition, you can't elaborate. You want to elaborate in terms of what's the cause. That's causality.
Yeah.
He said, one of Mara said about another one, he said that this man is not does not come from a woman. He's not Yilud Isha. Yilud Isha. See, what do they mean? They meant to say, because they recognize, Chazal recognize that all our instincts start from birth, from infancy.
And in the very process of childbirth, right there, the instincts are involved. In the very process of childbirth. So I say, Lavia Lurisha means that the person was so great that they couldn't notice any instinctual content. That's an amazing thing. That's an amazing thing. Even though a person was raised in the greatest possible situation, can't be there was no Bechira. Even if it appears that way, internally there was definitely Bechira. The solution to that? That's right, exactly. Now you get it right. Causing free will, being able to choose, is a misnomer. Because you can't use methods of analysis when it comes to free will, because free will you're maintaining is devoid by definition of all types of analysis. Because what is analysis? Analysis is causality. So you can't use all those tools that you're trying to use. That's the dilemma. That's why when you realize that, then when you realize what's involved in the idea of free will, you realize the solution is the very recognition of the problem. You don't have to look for any other solution. You can't look for solutions. And you can't start looking for an analysis of how it works. There's no way, because you're saying it's beyond analysis. That's the definition. You're just saying it is. That's it. All you can say about free will is it is. Can't go any further. The process of free will, by definition, does not lend itself to theoretical analysis. Because all theoretical analysis is based upon the concept of causation. In other words, once a person recognizes what free will is, he recognizes an area he intrinsically cannot examine. You don't have the tools to examine it. It's like it's the same thing. It's not the same thing, but I mean to say, it's similar to the idea of analysis of God, which is impossible, because you can only analyze the world, the created world, but you cannot analyze the Creator, because there are no tools with which you can do it. In that respect, Adam is like a Tzalim Alekim. When you use the word determinant, you say there are no determinants in Bechira. See, there again, you always get trapped in the same thing. When you use determinants, what you're thinking about is like determinants of physics. This causes this, and that causes that. What you're saying by man, and this was, I think I had it this way last time, when you're saying that man has Bechira, what you're saying is man is a gavra, he's not a chafta. If he's not a chafta, he's not subject to determinants. He's a different, unique entity. And he makes the choice. And he's not subject to determinants. He's not a determinant. You're saying he's above determinants. That's the definition. Everything in the world is a world of chefzes. But man is a gavra. He's unique. Now you can't apply the rules of chefzes to the gavra. So the whole term determinant doesn't apply. Determinant is a nice word for physics. Not for a human being. Exactly. You can only say that the results of the choice stem from him himself. But you can't analyze it in the manner of determinism, because then you're borrowing your tools from the world of causation, and you can't use those tools over here, by definition. You understand? And I conceive of the answer to the problem of Bechira. He really can't have a conception of God either, because that's the exact same thing, that it's beyond those tools and those mechanisms which are used for analysis. The question is that when you say schar va'onesh, so you always think that the person is the cause of his own undoing. All right. Now you're in the world of causality. You see. Yeah. But again, there's the same mistake. When you use that word cause, you can't use it in the same manner as you understand causality. You can't use it that way. You could say what you should say is he's the source. He's the source since it's a phenomenon that cannot be examined in the light of all the knowledge that the human mind can grasp from the world of causality, which is the whole realm of knowledge, you can only say that he's the source of his state. But that's it. You can't say more than that. The word cause is bad. You could say there is no other cause, no external cause besides himself that is responsible for this. It's a unique process. The process is one that defies our ability to understand, because our ability to understand is limited to the world of causality. I mean, there are many forms to the question, but it's the same question. The question is, well, how does free will work? That question is an intrinsic contradiction. Because if you ask me how it works, you want to know the cause. There is no cause. There is no causality there. You can't say, how does it work?
How does it work? Implies that it, how do things work? How does the clock work? The clock works by determinants, by cause. You can't say how this works. That question is inappropriate. Okay. Free will does not mean that you're going to understand the process. That, by definition, you can't understand. It just means there are no other determinants. That's it.